This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In the early morning of July 6th, a train carrying 72 cars of highly explosive fuel rolled down a hill into the small Quebec town of Lac-Mégantic. Speeding through town, the cars jumped the tracks and exploded, setting fire to the town center and killing 47 people. Shortly after the horrific accident, we spoke with freelance reporter Laura Beeston. Beeston was on the scene the day of the crash for the Montreal Gazette and related what she saw as she reached the Quebec town.
It's just incredible. If you take a look at the scope of the damage, there are four or five blocks that are just gone. Commercial, residential, the downtown core, there are some ancestral buildings. This town is it's a railroad town, and its library and its archives are gone. The level of destruction is incredible. I can't impress that enough. It's in the middle of such a beautiful place, you know, like around all this destruction is just the most picturesque scenery that you could possibly imagine. It's quite lovely and then also quite devastating.
That was Laura Beeston reporting for the Montreal Gazette after the Lac-Mégantic train derailment and fire back in July. That accident led a lot of people to question how well regulated our railways are as they transport hazardous material through our towns and across our countries. Turns out it's not always clear to rail officials, let alone town and regional officials and safety personnel, what's being carried in rail cars. Sometimes the cars aren't even properly labeled. We're going to take a look at freight rail safety today on the program. We're joined by Kim McRail, a reporter for the Globe and Mail out of Ontario, Canada, and William Vantuono, editor-in-chief of Railway Age. That's a national rail trade publication. Kim, Bill, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you.
Kim, could you just catch us up to speed briefly on what is now known, first of all, about the causes of that accident in Quebec? I know that Canada's Transportation Safety Board has been investigating. What's been released so far?
Sure. So the Transportation Safety Board is still, the investigation is still going on, and they haven't come up with anything definitive on the cause. But what we know at this point is that it looks like a series of things that seem to have been factors, at least, in what happened. And one is you have this train that's carrying crude oil come into a town that's uphill of Lac-Mégantic, and the town is called Nantes. It parked there on the main track, not on the siding, which is where, you know, there's often a sort of short piece of track called a siding that trains can park on that often have a little bit of a safety. They can be a little bit safer because they have a system in place that would stop the train from moving forward if it rolled accidentally. So this train was actually parked on the main track, from what we understand, and it appears that there were not enough of the handbrakes, which are these very large sort of steering wheel-like brakes on the top of the cars. Not enough of them appear to have been applied.
So is that just operator error?
That's what it looks like, and that's what the company has. Montreal Main and Atlantic has pinned a lot of blame on the operator. There's, you know, still an investigation going on that, but the Transportation Safety Board has said that the train wouldn't have rolled forward if enough handbrakes had been applied. So they've raised some questions about that, and that would be operator error if that was the case. And there's a fire in the locomotive in the middle of the night, which the fire department put out. But that appears to have released the air brakes on the train, which are the other braking systems. So when you don't have the air brakes, then you have to rely on the handbrakes, which is why, given the questions about whether enough were applied, the thinking at this point is that that's what allowed the train to move forward. The last factor that is kind of an important one to think about is that the oil that was being carried on that train is from the Bakken region, and that's the sort of North Dakota and in Canada, Saskatchewan area that a lot of oil is being taken from, and from shale rock right now. And that there is some consideration that the oil from there could be more volatile than other oil that's carried, and that could have been a factor in the kinds of explosions that happened that night.
The safety board, as you said, is still working on all of this information and hasn't come out with final reports yet. But there were some initial recommendations that the safety board made right after the accident. And I think made those to Transport Canada. Can you tell us what the recommendations have been in terms of what rail companies should be doing differently?
Yeah, absolutely. So that's right. Very not long at all after the accident happened, there was a recommendation that for a series of new rules that included better securement for trains. So, and one of that was actually making sure companies have a real clear policy on exactly how many handbrakes an employee should apply, because a lot of companies and I have looked at some of the handbooks for rail companies on applying handbrakes, and often, depending on the rail company, they have different specific rules. But sometimes, when it comes to parking on a slope, which was the case in the Lac-Mégantic accident, not all companies are clear about how many or what percentage of handbrakes actually have to be applied. So that there is, and that was a recommendation from the Transportation Safety Board, which Transport Canada, our federal department, put into place. So that's a requirement now. There are a couple of others, including just keeping locomotives locked up when a train is left unattended, and not leaving a train that's carrying dangerous goods on a main track, which was also the situation with the crash in Lac-Mégantic. And there was one other that came out a few months later, so it's more recent, which is that the oil that's moving by rail, when oil is being moved by rail, it should be tested by anyone who's moving it. And that's to make sure that it's actually being identified properly, so the correct volatility is actually outside the tank, and that if someone who is a first responder, for example, is dealing with an accident, they know how volatile the substance is.
Because they weren't labeled correctly in the Lac-Mégantic disaster.
That's exactly right, yeah. They were labeled as a class that most other crude oil is also labeled as. So most crude oil is labeled as class 3. But in fact, they should have been a more volatile class 2, which is the same kind of labeling that you would use for propane, for example. And that's because of the specific properties of the oil that was being carried.
We're talking today about freight rail safety. And listeners, you can call in with your questions. What do you want to know about how freight is regulated? Who knows what about what's being carried on our railways? Our number is 1-800-639-2211. It's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We've been talking with Kim McCrail, a reporter for the Globe and Mail, who covers the rail industry. And we're also joined by Bill Vantuono, who's the editor-in-chief of Railway Age. That's a national rail publication. It's based out of New York City. And Bill, the Federal Railroad Administration in the United States also issued a safety action plan after this accident. Do they differ from what Kim was telling us about Canada's safety plans?
Not substantially. The U.S. and Canadian railroads are pretty much follow the same safety standards. They're regulated very very similarly. So for what Kim described was not anything different than what the FRA would set as far as parking a train on a grade, on a main line, locking down the locomotives. As far as the number of handbrakes applied, though, I wouldn't say that there are standards, but it depends upon the length of the train, the weight of the train, the number of locomotives that are hauling the train. There's probably some kind of ratio or formula that's followed. I don't know what that formula is, but trains are operated very very strictly according to again the number of cars, the weight, the weight of the train, or as we say, trailing tons. So. And it can be pretty complex, but the train operator or the locomotive engineer and or conductor need to know those things, and they need to know if they are going to tie a train up or tie it down is the correct term. Exactly how many cars need to have the handbrakes applied?
In terms of train operators knowing what's actually being carried? Do they always know what's being carried in the freight cars?
Yes, they would have to know. They're provided with a manifest. Typically, in the United States and Canada, we operate freight trains with two-person crews, an engineer and a conductor. On some railroads, there is a one-person crew where the engineer also functions as a conductor. A manifest is given provided to the operator. The operator knows exactly, he or she has to know exactly what's in the train, how many cars, the trailing tons, because that's going to determine how the train is operated. And on top of that, at least in the United States, and I'm sure it's true in Canada, all locomotive engineers have to carry a federal license. And you also have to be qualified on a section of line. You don't just get in a train and run it. You have to have experience on that particular section of line. You have to know the grades, the curves, the signals, and you're tested on this before you're allowed to operate.
So the people who are operating the train must know, are required to know what's actually being carried, not just the weight of it and how many cars they're trailing, but Bill, you're saying they would know whether it's natural gas or crude oil or diesel?
Yes, that's correct, yes. Mm-hmm.
So, Kim, that was a big problem in the Lac-Mégantic disaster because, as you mentioned, what was labeled on the outside of the freight, the volatility of the fuel being carried, wasn't properly labeled. And I understand there's actually been some news this morning out of Canada about making sure that all railways provide municipalities with information about what's being carried on trains.
Yeah, that's right. It was actually just a couple of hours ago, the Minister of Transportation here announced that there will be, beginning now, actually, there are rules requiring railways to give municipalities information about the types of dangerous goods that are moving through their territory, as well as the volume. The information, as we understand it so far, will be on an annual basis. So bigger rail companies such as CN and CP, Canadian National and Canadian Pacific, will be required to break down the information. I believe they still give it annually, but they break it down into quarters. Smaller companies don't have to break it down into quarters.
When you say annually, do you mean after the fact or before
that,
the fact?
That it will be after the fact. And that's municipalities. We have a Federation of Canadian Municipalities that's been pushing for this, and they've said so far they're actually pretty happy with this, even though it's information that's given after the fact. Because it helps them look at least at, it helps municipalities at least look at trends in what's moving through and help their first responders know how to deal with something if there is an accident. But it wouldn't be surprising to see a push for something that's a little bit more more proactive than that, perhaps, where it's not just after the fact.
Bill, is there any chance that that might happen in the United States as well? There was a significant explosion recently in Alabama. For first responders to be able to respond appropriately, is there any way for them to get the information quickly?
Well, there is. I would have to say that one of the problems, one of the causes of the luck. Magantique, I want to pronounce that correctly, as a New Jerseyite, was that the first responders, what they did was when they reached the locomotive that was on fire. So there were three units. Correct me if I'm wrong, but there were three units. One was left running to keep the air in the air brake system in the brake pipe, so the brakes would remain on. The pneumatic brakes, and that was the locomotive that caught fire. So the standard procedure when a locomotive catches fire, there's an emergency cutoff switch on the side right where the fuel tank is located. You press that switch and the engine shuts down. When the engine shuts down, then the air pressure starts to gradually bleed out of the system, and then the brakes would release. Now, if the handbrakes were applied properly, and the train still shouldn't have moved. But In terms of reporting, the railroads, the Class 1 railroads are required. These are the big carriers, CNCP, BNSF, Norfolk Southern, CSX, Union Pacific, Kansas City Southern. There, I named all of them, the big seven. They report to the Association of American Railroads on a weekly basis what they're moving in terms of carloads. It's broken down very specifically. I think it probably needs to be more and better communication between first responders and railroad dispatch centers. There needs to be maybe more intense training programs, and that's something the Class 1s, the big railroads with the resources to do this sort of thing, do on a regular basis. The smaller, bear in mind, there are seven big carriers, and there are 500 smaller carriers. And these smaller companies may not necessarily have the resources to provide these training programs. I would have to say that most first responders know what to do in the case of a railroad derailment. We have a center out in Pueblo, Colorado called the Transportation Technology Center that does conduct training courses for first responders.
But let me ask Kim on this.
But obviously there needs to be more of this.
Yeah, because Kim, in the disaster in Quebec, you were saying one of the issues was that actually on the tanker itself, on the car, it was listed as, I think you said, a Class 3 fuel, which would burn differently than a Class 2 fuel, which is what was actually in there. So who's supposed to monitor that?
Well, that's it's what they have said now is that it will be up to everybody who's pulling, including the people who are actually getting the oil out of the ground, moving them to the rail cars, loading them in, the railways who transport them, and the refinery that receives the oil at the end are all supposed to be, under the new rules, responsible for testing and making sure that the label, they actually refer to it as the identification on the outside of the train is correct. In the specific case in Lac-Mégantic, there are questions as to whether, frankly, that would have made a difference in terms of what's on the outside. Because when when firefighters responded to the fire in the locomotive on the night that this occurred, they likely, from what we've heard, would have dealt with the fire in the locomotive the same way, whether you had a number 2 or a 3 on the outside of the cars themselves. And the problem there was that they didn't know. They may not have known that there would have been a problem with air bleeding off. And even if they did, there would have been an expectation that there would have been enough handbrake supplied for the train not to have moved. There, in the particular case, it's not clear it would have made a difference, but there have been a lot of requests for it, and there are scenarios in which you can imagine that there might be that rail cars might be treated differently if you know that the material is more volatile.
We are talking today about freight rail safety. We're looking at some recent changes, some guidelines from our National Rail Safety Committees in Vermont and nationally as well as in Canada. We're going to talk a little bit more specifically about Vermont coming up, as well as what kind of cars are actually on the rails and is that an issue. Listeners, if you have questions about rail safety, you can call 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today we're exploring rail safety and how we can avoid another accident like the train derailment and fire in Quebec this summer. If you have questions about who knows what, about what's being transported on our railways, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We're talking with Kim McCrail, reporter for the Globe and Mail, who covers Canadian rail issues, and William Vantuono, editor-in-chief of the trade publication Railway Age. And to drill down on what's happening in Vermont, let's turn now to Dan Delabriere, rail program director for the Vermont Department of Transportation. Dan, nice to talk with you.
Oh, nice to be on. Thank you.
We've got a couple of listener questions that I'd love to direct your way because they're Vermont-specific. Dennis wants to know who monitors rail safety and who makes sure, for example, that the wood-chip Burlington Electric cars one sees passing through Essex Junction every day won't catch fire. Who's monitoring the odd tank car that's passing through?
Well, in Vermont, actually in all states, what moves on the rails is monitored by the FRA, which is the Federal Rail Administration, because most rail products move across state lines. You know, it's not the jurisdiction of the states to monitor that. So the operator of the particular railroad, which in that case would be New England Central, would have to, you know, kind of file a plan with the FRA saying we're going to maintain our railroad to such a class, so we're going to run freight at a certain speed. And they file that plan with the FRA, and the FRA kind of monitors, you know, what they do on that rail line. So each, you know, every different rail lines are maintained at different classes.
Is there any question about that from municipalities in Vermont or even from the state wanting to have more information about what's actually on our tracks?
We do sort of monitor it, sort of helicopter view. We don't get into the day-to-day operations and the manifest on what actually move. But we do, you know, we work with our Vermont Emergency Management people to develop plans on if there was an incident in Vermont and how they would respond, and, you know, certain trainings on getting our first responders familiar with, you know, what does a locomotive look like? What does a tank car look like? What is, you know, different types of cars, and how would you respond to an incident if something did happen? So, you know, we do at that level sort of interact with what moves, but we don't get into the manifest and look at what moves every day.
David in Middlebury emailed us in to say, I'm wondering how much natural gas already traverses our railways and how the safety record both of hauling gas and of hauling hazardous freight in general compares to the safety record of pipelines for such things. David says, you know, here in Addison County, we're debating the proposed Vermont natural gas pipeline, and this information would be helpful. So first, Dan, to you about specifically Vermont, do you know how much natural gas is going through our railways?
We don't. The operators of Vermont, of railroads through Vermont, don't give us that information. I mean, we are here at V-Trans, we're really infrastructure-based. We get into, you know, if there's a project on the rail, if there's a bridge project or a rail road crossing project, signals, that type of thing, or an upgrade of a section of track, you know, we get into that. We don't get into, like I say, the day-to-day manifest and how much moves on each rail, what products move. You know, we have a general idea, but that stuff doesn't get reported to us.
Well, let me ask Bill then. Bill Vantuono, do you know across the country how much natural gas is going on our rails versus through pipelines?
As far as I know, very little, because the Pipeline and Hazardous Materials Safety Administration prohibits natural gas, which would be in liquefied form, from moving on a railroad unless a waiver is issued, and that's a safety regulation that the industry is looking at right now, because the industry is experimenting with using liquefied natural gas to fuel locomotives that would require what's called a fuel tender. Filled with LNG, but LNG by itself is not explosive. It vaporizes at a very, very low temperature. So there really isn't all that much natural gas, specifically LNG or even CNG, compressed natural gas, moving on the rails these days.
So not much. Do you think, Bill, that there's a problem with not having these stats at everybody's fingertips, or is this just the way it works and you're okay with it?
I wouldn't say there's a problem. I think the issue really is the construction of the tank cars themselves. Now, just to give you some statistics here, and this is all from the Association of American Railroads. There are roughly 92,000 tank cars moving flammable liquids, and approximately 78,000 of those might require retrofitting or phase out based on a proposal that the AAR has made to PHMSA or PHMSA. There are approximately 14,000 newer tank cars that today comply with higher safety standards. They may also require some upgrades. And I'd like to add that since 2011, since October 2011, all DOT – and these tank cars are known as DOT 111 cars. DOT 111 tank cars built to – and this is what Kim referred to. It's actually called packing groups. Packing groups 1 and 2, and those are for the most hazardous materials, crude oil and ethanol. All tank cars ordered since October 2011 adhere to the Association of American Railroads Tank Car Committee standards, and these are voluntary standards. It's not a rule. Thicker, more puncture-resistant shell or jacket, extra protective head shields at both ends of the tank car, and additional protection for top fittings or valves. And the AAR has now urged the Federal Railroad Administration to formalize what the industry has been following in tank car construction and make it a rule that they all must be built this way. The tank cars are being built this way, but it's got to be put in the law.
And I want to come back to that in just a minute. But before we do, Dan DeLabriere, I want to ask you one other question about Vermont's rail line specifically, which is, you know, who's making sure that the actual tracks themselves are in good repair and that the bridges are being inspected? Because I assume that the state might own some, but also they're privately owned in some cases?
Yeah. So in Vermont, there's approximately 600 miles of active rail. About 300, little over 300 miles of that is actually the property itself. The actual land is actually owned by the state of Vermont. The state of Vermont leases that 300 miles of track to an operator. So our lease agreement says that the operator has to maintain that section of track that he's leasing at a certain level. Now, the level is established between the operator and the FRA. So if the operator says, I'm going to maintain this track to a track 2 level, then I'm going to run my freight at a certain speed over that track. I'm going to maintain it to that level. So the operator is required to do inspections, and they do them. They do them weekly. FRA comes up and checks, make sure the records are correct, make sure they're inspecting at the proper times. FRA might go out and spot check. So there are inspections that are happening, and I will tell you that Vermont's pretty fortunate. We have some tremendous operators in the state. We have a privately owned company that owns 2 out of the 10 railroads in Vermont that was named, you know, the safest railroad company in the country. And then we've got another operator who owns 5 of the 10, who's just got a great, great track record. So, you know, Vermont's pretty fortunate. We've got some very responsible operators in the state. And, you know, as far as what our condition of track is, we've got different tracks at different conditions. So you can't say, are they all in the best condition ever? They're at the condition that the operators has selected. And I will tell you that our operators are meeting or exceeding the expectations on the track class that they've selected.
That's Dan DeLabriere. He's VTRAN's Rail Program Director. Dan, thanks for taking a minute to talk with us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And let's go to Andrew, who's calling in from Cornwall. Hi, Andrew. Go right ahead.
Jane, hi. Well, it's great that Vermont has been pretty fortunate up to this point. But my question is relates to if we're not so fortunate at some point in time. And as you know, we're going to have there's a plan to have a fracked gas pipeline put through our community, and we don't want it. Let's say the thing were put through, and let's say there were an accident. It's my understanding that the same as the accident happened in Texas the other day, that if such an explosion were to occur, it's so vast, they evacuated people from 2 miles around.
Well, Andrew, what you're talking about is a pipeline explosion, and we don't have experts here who have the ability to talk about a pipeline explosion. But let me put your question to Kim McRail about first responders and explosions of this sort? Because, you know, Bill has told us that there's not much natural gas being tracked through on rail. However, these are volatile fuels, and first responders have to be able to respond. And in many cases, in situations like this, the response of the local community is to wait until the fire burns out because they don't have the ability to deal with an explosion of that magnitude. So, Kim, what is there for first responders in an explosion on a rail line when we're talking about this kind of volatile fuels?
Sure. Well, a lot of first responders will generally, in fire departments across Canada, and I'm sure across North America, do get training in dealing with all sorts of different volatile materials. But what they've said here in the push for more information here about what's being moved through on trains is that they really feel that if they were more aware of the specific kinds of materials moving through their particular community, and I'm sure this could apply to pipelines as well, which is the Andrew's question, if they were more aware of that specific material, they could make sure that they have the whatever they would use. And often when you're dealing with volatile materials, firefighters use foam to put out a fire rather than water. But any other sorts of things that they would need to bring with them to the scene of an accident to fight a fire, they say that they could be more prepared for those things and just have them a little bit more top of mind. So that's sort of where the issue stands here.
Bill, I just want to go to you for just a couple of seconds here, because you were talking about a specific kind of tank car at the DOT 111, and that cars that have been made in the last couple of years are more puncture resistant than the older cars. But I think most of the freight cars on the tracks are these older cars that are perhaps a little bit easier to puncture, and you're saying we need to have some regulation about that.
Yes, that is true. This is what the Association of American Railroads has called for formally, to either retrofit or phase out the DOT 111 tank cars built before, essentially since before October 2011, and the ones built since then, if they require improvements, to improve those.
That's William Vantuono, editor-in-chief of the trade publication Railway Age. We've also been speaking with Kim McRail, a reporter for the Globe and Mail. She's based in Ottawa, Canada. Kim and Bill, thank you so much for talking with us today about freight rail safety.
Thanks.
You're very welcome.
Coming up, Dartmouth College continues to struggle with drinking and sexual assault violations on campus. Two fraternities have been suspended this fall, and the president of the college recently spoke to faculty about how to deal with these issues. We'll talk with a Valley News reporter who's been covering the story. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This week, the president of Dartmouth met with faculty members of the college to look at the problems of binge drinking and sexual assault on campus. This is not a new conversation for the Hanover, New Hampshire Ivy League school. A fraternity was suspended last week for drug and alcohol violations, and another was suspended in October. Reporter Sarah Brubeck of the Valley News has been covering the story and joins us now from the Upper Valley. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
So, president of the college, Phil Hanlon, met with what I understand is a couple hundred faculty members actually off campus on Monday night to talk about some of the social problems that have been emerging on campus. These two recent fraternity suspensions, but also some worries about sexual assaults on campus?
Yes. So, they met at the Hanover Inn on Monday night. And so Hanlon only started his post in June, and this was the first time he gave a full speech about the social climate on campus and sexual assault and high-risk drinking. 2 weeks ago, he spoke to the general faculty for the first time, really the first address he'd had to just the faculty, and addressed academic issues. But this time, he focused particularly on social issues. And he's hinted that this is going to be something that he'll focus on, especially during this first year, because at his inauguration, he said that sexual assault and high-risk drinking were issues that needed to be addressed. But this is just the first time he formally discussed them.
Can you put those issues into a little bit of context for us? I mentioned those two recent fraternity suspensions. There have been other issues with fraternities. There have been issues around sexual assault on campus and how frequently that's occurring. Can you give us a little bit of context?
Yeah. So There have been two fraternity suspensions. One occurred in October. That's a temporary suspension in which the fraternity, some of the emails were leaked, some of their internal emails that they'd had dealing particularly with pledges were leaked on Gawker. And that being a temporary suspension means that they could still have the permanent outcome hasn't been decided. And then another fraternity was suspended just last week for violating the drug and alcohol policy at the college. It's important to note that there's been a lot of social tension at Dartmouth recently. In early 2012, for instance, Rolling Stone wrote a piece about hazing at Sigma Alpha Epsilon after a fraternity member had written in a student newspaper about hazing that had occurred at the fraternity. And in the spring of 2013, Dartmouth canceled a day of classes after a group of students protested that, quote, Dartmouth has a problem with racism, sexism, and homophobia. And in the Department of Education announced in the spring that it is doing an investigation for Dartmouth for a Title IX complaint because of students complained that the college has mishandled sexual assault reports as well as racism and homophobia complaints, but a lot of it came from sexual assault. All of that history has put pressure on Hanlon to address these issues. There's also sexual assault has been an issue at Dartmouth. I mean, it's an issue on all campuses. It's not just Dartmouth, but it's talked about a lot at Dartmouth. I mean, for instance, just as a reporter, I'm dealing with a sexual assault case that's going through the Grafton Superior Court, where a former student is, you know, alleged of rape. But that's something that happens at campuses across the nation as well.
Well, has Dartmouth taken any concrete steps recently to try to address these issues?
Yeah. So for sexual assault particularly, Hanlon talked on Monday about this new Dartmouth Bystander initiative. It just started in the summer, where students are being trained to basically be bystanders for sexual assault. If they're at a party, if they're or just on campus in general, and they see a situation that looks dangerous, they see a situation where they think this could end up with another student being sexually assaulted, they're being trained to react and handle that situation. Phil Hanlon also said that sexual assault will not be tolerated on campus. He said that at his speech, and that's the first time I've heard him publicly kind of make that statement. So that's kind of where they are with sexual assault. And Hanlon said on Monday that if the college is successful, they're likely to see reported numbers of the number of sexual assaults go up before they go down, because students will actually the idea is that students would actually be coming forward instead of just not telling the college about them.
Right. That question about are there more incidents or is it more reporting and being better reported? It sounds, Sarah, though, like some of the faculty members think the college really isn't doing enough to tamp down some of the social problems on campus. What did you hear from them during and after the meeting?
Yeah. So after they had a question and answer session after the meeting, and one professor stood up and said, you know, he thinks this is a good start, but the college is just going after the symptoms. Sexual assault and binge drinking are just symptoms of the greater social issues that are at Dartmouth. One good question from a faculty member was they asked if students are automatically expelled if it's determined that they are a perpetrator of an alleged sexual assault. And the dean of the college said, no, they're not automatically expelled. She said students should be expected to be expelled, but it's not part of their policy that means that students automatically are expelled. So I think that's, you know, that was a concern of theirs as well. And there's also another faculty member talked about just the Greek system, and Hanlon made a lot of idea. He suggested a lot of things of how to allow students to have more social opportunities on campus outside of the Greek system. But a professor said, you know, that all sounds great, but the power that the Greek system currently has on campus is so high. Is there a way to make other social opportunities the same level as what the Greek system currently has?
Well, is there a feeling that the Greek system is the root of Dartmouth's social problems? Because it is often described as really dominating the social scene.
I think it's depending on who you ask. It does dominate the social scene. It definitely does. But, I mean, I've spoken with students just in interviews who've said, I'd like to see the Greek system, abolished. But I think at the same time, Hanlon has said that, you know, having more choices is better than having less. And he said that when I was interviewing him on Monday. And I think the Dartmouth social scene, there's 17 fraternities and there's 11 sororities. And it definitely does dominate the social scene. And I think that was part of where, you know, the when the classes were canceled in the spring, students were saying that Dartmouth has a problem. And I think all the students that I was talking to was saying, you know, that there weren't outlets for other students. It wasn't that, you know, they were saying, oh, everything's the issue with the Greek system, but there just weren't other outlets for students.
So there's not a conversation happening seriously about whether or not to eliminate fraternities altogether. I mean, if you look at some of the other schools, Middlebury banned fraternities in the 1990s. They do have co-ed social houses. Williams abolished fraternities earlier than that. Harvard doesn't allow them. Any sense that Dartmouth might look into whether or not it wants to keep them at all?
It's a good question. Right now, I don't know. I asked, actually, on Monday when I was speaking with Phil Hanlon, I asked him, you know, I said that I've spoken with students who have said, you know, eliminate the Greek system. And his response was, you know, more choices are better than less. And he wants social opportunities that contribute to the campus, not take away from it. But it's hard for me to say. I don't see any signs right now that President Hanlon or anyone at the college is about to say, okay, let's get rid of the fraternities. I think them, you know, suspending some fraternities and going through that judicial process is possibly their way of saying, you know, you're going to be, I think they're trying to hold fraternities accountable for when they break the policy, as they should be, but I don't see it them getting rid of the fraternity system right now, at least not from the reporting I've done.
Sarah Brubeck is a reporter for the Valley News, and we have links to her recent stories about Dartmouth College and some of these social issues, as well as the president speaking with faculty members this week about what might be done. You can find those stories at vpr.net/Vermont Edition. Sarah, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Now we're going to turn to your messages to the program. Vermont Edition producer Sage Van Wing joins me to read from our virtual mailbag. Hi, Sage.
Hey, Jane. So on Friday, we discussed Vermont's new health exchange with executives from the two insurance companies offering plans, MVP and Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Christina is worried that if her health plan is canceled, she's not going to be able to afford coverage. She wrote to us saying the closest thing offered more than doubles our out-of-pocket maximum. And in addition, premiums will not have decreased significantly and in some cases have increased for similar plans.
We also heard from BB, who wrote, Vermont was the only state to make it mandatory for companies smaller than 50 employees to buy from Vermont Health Connect. The president didn't say, you can keep your coverage except in Vermont. Shouldn't small businesses in Vermont get the same rights as other Americans?
We also spoke with Representative Peter Welch on Friday about the new health exchange, and that's what Sage is referring to. Now, last Wednesday, we discussed funding issues for the federal low-income energy subsidization program called LIHEAP. Many of you suggested that the state should put more money into funding for weatherization programs.
But Mark counters that weatherization programs don't always benefit low-income Vermonters. If the greatest proportion of LIHEAP recipients are renters, Mark writes, how do we get landlords to make these energy efficiency improvements to their units without then raising rents on their tenants to cover the costs of taking weatherization steps?
And Donna reminds us about a few other programs that help people heat their homes in the winter. She says low-income Vermonters can come into the community action offices for crisis assists to help with covering fuel costs. In addition, there's money from the Warmth Program to also assist with heating costs.
And we're going to close today with a nod to comedian Stephen Colbert, who took a little dig at Vermont on his Comedy Central program this week. The satirist issued a few fake demands on behalf of his fictitious dictatorship of Colbert Nation.
Lastly, I demand the international community respect my right to continue developing the Colbert Nation's nuclear program. It is for energy, even though I have pledged to wipe Vermont off the map.
We will drive you into Lake Champlain!
Well, we asked you on Facebook for your reactions to those fake fighting words, and here are a few of your comments.
John writes, if he were to come up here during November, he'd think that someone beat him to the punch.
David says he loves with faux hate.
Michael speculates, he's just upset because he couldn't get a hold of any heady topper.
John says, I guess he got a bad batch of maple syrup.
And lastly, Elizabeth says, you laugh until it's your state. Except, I still laughed. For the joy that we were even recognized on national TV.
Well, please keep your comments to Vermont Edition coming. We love to know what you think about the program.
Tweet us, like our Facebook page, or post to the online discussion we have for each program at vpr.net or email vermontedition@vpr.net.
And you can tell us what you think about Stephen Colbert's faux fighting words on our Facebook page. Sage, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Jane.
That will do it for today's show. Tomorrow, what makes the place you live in feel like home? Do you need to put up curtains and hang art on the walls? Or is it a fireplace in the wintertime and a nice big couch that gives your house a comforting soul? We're going to talk with writer Howard Mansfield about the elusive qualities of a dwelling. And you can share your thoughts with us again by emailing vermontedition@vpr.net. Our program is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing. We have production assistance from Tim Johnson. Peter Biello directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.